Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. If you've ever experienced the frustration of trying to navigate the healthcare maze, you won't want to miss Frank Lally coming in the second half of today's show. He's an award-winning investigative journalist. For the last 8 years, he's been focused purely on healthcare, and he's become known as the healthcare detective. His latest book is Your Best Healthcare Now, and he's got tons of tips and resources to help you save money on prescriptions, doctor visits, hospital bills. Tom Brokaw, the former NBC news anchor, said it helped him navigate through a ton of, you know what it's like, a ton of red tape when he himself was diagnosed with cancer. So that's coming up in the second half of today's show. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome someone who's had a very interesting life. I'm looking forward to learning more about her background. She is Jane Allison. She's the author of the memoir, The Sisters Antipodes, and three novels, The Love Artist, The Marriage of the Sea, and Natives and Exotics, and also the translator of Ovid's Stories of Sexual Transformation, Change Me. She's professor and director of creative writing at the University of Virginia. Jane Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And I should let listeners know your new book is called Nine Island. Lauren Graf on the cover here says it's full of sideways humor that devastates and illuminates all at once. So before we get into the book, let's just look a little bit at your background, because you've had an interesting life. It looks, you know, I'm sure you'd agree. You were born in Canberra, Australia. You grew up there and in U.S. Foreign Services until you were 11 years old, and then you moved around. Tell us how, what that was like, traveling and where you were.
Well, the traveling was wonderful, but actually more to the kind of heart of the life was the fact that I started out with my parents in the Australian Foreign Service, and then they, when I was 4 years old, met another couple in the U.S. Foreign Service and traded partners. So I ended up switching from Australian to American and growing up then as an American child from the time I was about five, with a unusual situation of having a kind of doubled family with my own mother and stepfather and my sister, and then a parallel version, my father and his wife and her little girls on the other side of the world. So the traveling was great, but this was sort of more what we thought about, or what I thought about growing up. So Washington was originally a foreign posting, and then Canberra was home, and then we were back in Washington, and then not too many more posts, just South America, and then I grew up otherwise mostly in D.C.
And so where do you consider home? Because I read in one of your books you discuss that. Where is home?
Well, for a long time, I really didn't know where home could be. I mean, it's funny, anyone who's grown up away from where they were born and where, say, their grandparents are, can have this kind of strange nostalgic idea about this place that's lost, and it becomes very mythological. And so Australia was that to me, but I knew nothing about it really, except a few memories and the books I had. In my adult life, I traveled quite a lot. I think I've lived in about 20 different cities, mostly in the U.S., but also in Italy, and then I spent 10 years in Germany until just 8 years ago. So I was really struggling for where home could be. I thought it might be any place where there were palm trees, because I had some old associations with that.
Right.
But then I lived in Miami for 6 years, and it turned out, no, the palm trees didn't do the trick. So even though it was beautiful there, I am now in Charlottesville, which would not normally have counted for me as home, but it is near Washington, and my mother is here, and there are things that feel homey, like oak trees and cicadas and the kinds of things that were really a part of summers when I was growing up in D.C. from my teenage years. So for now, the house I bought that I live in with my garden, which is dying, nevertheless, it's home.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, I can definitely relate to that, because when you've lived in two different countries, you know, almost equally as I have done, it's like, where really is home? I always tell people it's where I hang my hat, you know, that old saying.
Mm-hmm. It works.
That works. So you did quite a few things before you you were a Miami News Times. You worked for the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Washington City Paper, the Miami New Times. You've been a freelance editor and illustrator. Had you always wanted to write?
No, I never wanted to write. I sometimes still wonder about it. I didn't at all. I mean, as a kid, I did what I think a lot of kids do who have any creative impulses. I drew pictures, I drew cartoons, I wrote some little stories then. So I did write as a kid, but then I really liked drawing, so I drew in my teen years and then at college. And I remember I had friends in college who were taking writing courses and writing novels, and I remember being just outraged, thinking, how dare you? I mean, how do you possibly think you can do that? And so I was a little surprised when years later, it was actually I had worked for the National Endowment for the Humanities, which was a great job, by the way, and then I went to grad school in classics for 1 year before realizing I really was not cut out for that, and I wanted to do illustration, and I ended up beginning to rewrite the story I was supposed to be illustrating. And so from there, it just sort of led into writing, and at that point, I was now living in New Orleans, working at Tulane as a speechwriter for the university president, and strangely enough, writing those kinds of speeches led me to write fiction.
Isn't that interesting? I always it's really interesting the twists and turns that people's careers take and the path where the path leads them.
Mm, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about this book. It's as I said, called Nine Island. You've described it as a non-fiction novel or autofiction or a semi-imagined memoir. So come on, fess up. How much of this is true? How much of is it made up?
Most of it is. Well, let me just back up one bit, is that I had written, like you said, thank you, three novels and a memoir, and I had done this translation of Ovid's stories, which are in poetic form. And I just found myself really, really, and teaching also made me think about these things more. I found myself just frustrated with the idea of the kind of plotting that you do in fiction and making a lot of things up. I found that working in memoir, you know, you're trying to make sense of things that are true. And you're trying to put them into some kind of form that has movement and meaning, but you're trying to be truthful. And in translation, you're sort of working with a given in the same way. You're trying to get someone else's words to come through in your own language as well as possible. So when I was sort of getting the fictional impulses again, I realized I just do not want to make a lot of things up. I'm more compelled by looking at things around me or in my life or in the lives of people nearby that are true, that all start to feel connected in a way that might all belong together in one book. And I wanted the form to be a little bit like a novel and a little bit like a memoir and a little bit like poetry and not really one or the other. But in terms of the stuff that happens in this book, I compressed things that happened over two summers and added in a few things from other periods, but it's pretty close to real experience. I mean, the building that my character lives in, the people she meets, things that happen with her mother, she encounters this duck, she has this cat. I mean, these things were all based on reality, and I was just trying to make them inhabit the same story.
Right, and the story really takes a look at love, especially in later life, and love and the lack of love, and, you know, people living with their cats in later life, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some very poignant parts in it, and there's some very funny parts in it. It's also written with such brevity. I really appreciated that because I hate when I have to go through five pages to find out one thing. Why did you choose to write it the way that you did?
I think because I had written it. Most people who write, I you know, you go through so many drafts and versions, and along the way you hate what you're doing. And I had an early version when I was still trying to sort out what it was about. And I just found myself just drowning in these big lugubrious paragraphs. And I thought, I just can't stand, I don't like reading that kind of thing much anymore, and I don't want to write it. I want something more airy and with potency, hopefully. I mean, with some density and substance, but where you have space on the page and you have room to think and move around. And part of it comes from reading, I suppose, some poetry, but also the fragments. A lot of people are working with fragments these days, and some of it can be kind of cheating, but a lot of it isn't. It really is letting you think in between passages, which is important. So I was aiming for something that gave the reader room and gave me as a writer room and fluidity as well.
Mm-hmm. So the book begins with Jay. You don't share her name, but Jay, the character, the voice of the book, if you will, reconnecting with an old love. And that was, how much of that was true and how much of it is made up? It sounded like really, it sounded very truthful when I was reading it.
Oh, it was true. It's true. Definitely reconnecting with the old love. I did not include all of the truth, but everything that is there is true. Yes, so she reconnects with an old love, and this is after she has been, she's, I don't say how old she is, but you can guess that she's about 50, interestingly, not unlike myself, and she's been married for 20 years, but that had a sad end, and she decides to go and revisit old boyfriends. She goes on what she calls a heat-seeking tour of old boyfriends to see if there's something she missed along the way, because it seems so frightening to go out into the world, and also, you know, you don't want to waste some possibility that might still be there. So
right.
She drives up and down Route 95, reconnecting with various old boyfriends, most of them disastrous, and then along comes the one that had been the love she had when she was very young, 19, the first great love, and reconnects with him, and it seems so hopeful, and it seems like actually there could be a happy end, but no, he retreats to his stone house on a hill with his dog, so she heads back down to Miami with her cat. So there we are with that.
And so the Florida really is another character in the book, which I love when we have place as a character, if you will. And so why Florida? Was it the palm trees that took you there?
Well, it's where I was living. I mean, really, this was all based on, I sort of compressed the summers of 2011 and 2012, and that's where I was living then. I hadn't gotten the job at Virginia yet, so I was still there. And it was so endemic to, I mean, I had begun writing something else about a woman who is alone and trying to decide whether it's time to retire from love, but meanwhile having a pretty active fantasy life about men, real or not, and taking walks every day on the Venetian Causeway, which is this man-made causeway that connects several man-made islands in Biscayne Bay between Miami and Miami Beach. And it's very, very beautiful and lush. And there are the trees, and there are the fauna and the birds and, you know, beautiful people running and so on. So she's taking lots of walks and thinking about whether she should retire from love while she's fantasizing about all kinds of other things. And she's translating Ovid's stories of sexual change. So everything is coming together, and it just did happen in Miami. So it had to happen in the book in Miami.
Mm. Now, in the book, Jay, the main character, questions should she retire from love. And a nurse that she befriended said, if you retire from love, you retire from life. Do you believe that?
Well, let's see. I'm still trying to decide. Actually, I still have hope that it should be possible to live in a more islandy way. If, you know, why not? But I think the woman in the book certainly meant it when she said it, and her own life bore it out in a very strong way. So I'm gonna hedge. I'm gonna hedge on that one.
Fair enough. You'll just put it down to fiction, right? That bit. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. We will continue our conversation with Jane Allison, author of Nine Island, when we come back. And she's mentioned a couple of times Ovid, and so we're going to share who Ovid is and why it's significant to Jane's work. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
it's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Coming up October 27th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. What's next? If you've ever asked yourself what's next, learn to double down on your existing strengths, interests, and experiences with Jenny Blake, former Google career strategist and author of Pivot, The Only Move That Matters Is Your Next One. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD3.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
You found us. Maybe you've been guided to listen. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Jane Allison, and her new book is called Nine Island, and it's a story of a solitary woman living in a Miami high-rise apartment, and she considers retiring from love. She's obsessed with Ovid's poems, and so I want to ask you, Jane, because we've mentioned this that name several times in this conversation so far, why he was so significant, who he is and why he's so significant to you.
Ovid is a Latin writer, Roman writer from 2,000 years ago. He was sort of the Playboy Mick Jagger of Rome in his time. he wrote love poems, a kind of manual for love, a manual for surviving love afterwards. And they were beautiful and very, very clever. He could be quite wicked, but he also wrote a book called The Metamorphoses, which is a full-length epic poem, which reads in a way like a novel about change, about transformations, and there are transformations of girls into trees and boys into pools and men into stones and all sorts of things, but many of them are motivated by desire or by the absence of desire, and the kinds that I was focusing on when I was translating his work a couple of years ago were the changes that were wrought by erotic love and erotic fear. And so a girl not wanting ever to be touched or to become a woman who just runs for her life and then turns into a tree rather than being touched and owned by anybody. And I first encountered Ovid when I was 19 in college, and I was studying Latin, and Anne Carson, the wonderful classicist and poet, was my teacher then, and we were reading Ovid, and I just felt as if he was suddenly speaking to me. He was producing these tiny stories that just told everything that I needed to know about this strange land of love and its frightfulness. A story called Echo and Narcissus about a boy who is so beautiful and so perfect and so complete he needs no one, and a girl who, of course, falls horribly in love with him, and she doesn't even have the ability to speak on her own. She has to have someone speak, and then she echoes them. And that just felt to me like my situation at the time, being right in love with someone who was so contained, and around him I was an idiot. And so when I read the Ovid, it turned, teenage angst into something really beautiful and ancient and with its own power. So when I first read Ovid, it was actually the same time I met the one I call in the book Sir Gold. So they're always linked in my mind. So Ovid sort of naming my situation with this boy I was so in love with, and the one that my narrator then reconnects with, 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So Ovid, I was... In his own life, he wrote The Metamorphoses, which had a lot of kind of risky material in it regarding authority. And between that and, who knows, something he did or his earlier poems about sex, he was banished. He was exiled from Rome by the Emperor Augustus. And So the man about town, this very cosmopolitan figure, was simply sent away to the edge of the Black Sea, where he lived and died alone. So a character, a man who wrote poems about people who lost their own ability to speak. I mean, as a tree, you're not speaking anymore. This is what happened to him. He became removed from the world he knew, and he could no longer even speak the language until he finally taught it to himself. So this figure, as the kind of guide and of you know, love and sexual change, and also someone who was so ends up so exiled and banished and alone, he just seemed like the guiding principle for my character as she is trying to decide whether she wants to exile her own self from love now as she gets older and is sort of far away from her own young beauty and all of the things that came with it.
Right. And in some ways, her exile is her apartment in Florida, looking out the window all the time, right?
Yeah, definitely looking out the window and looking at all the other condo inhabitants across the way with or without binoculars.
Yeah, there were little, not all the way through the book, but there were a couple of little places where I thought of Miss Brill, the story of Miss Brill. I don't know why, but that story really resonated with me about this woman who was thinking she was getting out there and enjoying life because she'd go to the park every Sunday, but then one day she realized she was quite sad and quite alone, and it was just a very touching story. And there were a couple of little pieces in here where I felt an element of that.
Yeah, and my character, she goes to the pool and swims every day, and she takes her long walks, and she communicates with her mother by phone, and she has text message exchanges, but she is pretty alone. But what she's trying to do is figure out if that's really so bad. You know, if you come into the world and you are just alone in your skin, you know, who said that you have to have a partner? And, I mean, of course, partly she's protesting because she is lonely and has loved and has not gotten the love she wanted, but also it's just really trying to sort it out philosophically. Like, why, you know, why can we not feel contained and content alone? Why is there this idea, this need, wherever it comes from, that, you know, that you're missing something if you do not have another person?
There is a huge difference between solitude and feeling lonely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think some people don't get that.
Mm, yeah.
I'm wondering,
you can go back and forth between the two in 20 minutes. You feel very contained and solo, and then you can think, wow, wouldn't it be nice if someone else were here? And then go right back to feeling contained again.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you shared with friends, colleagues, that you were writing this story, and if everybody had a viewpoint on this.
You mean on the question of whether it's all right to be alone?
And love in general, and, you know, is it worth it? Should you retire or should you stay?
Well, as I was writing it, I did include a friend of mine who I call Kay in the book. She did send text saying, you are not ready to retire, damn it, go out there, you know. So she was very strong on that. And then the woman in the building, who was called Anne in the building, feels very passionately that no, you should not, you know, it's good to be with another person, it's good to have a mate. So those are the things that are being said all the time. And so in a way, the narrator is combating that. And I obviously myself was combating that because, I mean, even now I had a book party the other night and very, very good friends and dear people, but one came up to me and said, you know, don't give up on love. I'm thinking, I'm fine. But it's generally the idea is the people want people to be with people. They don't want people to be alone.
I think that's a key thing. I think some people feel uncomfortable with people being alone.
Yeah, exactly.
You say in the book, Jay says in the book, I'm just going to read this here. I will always love you no matter what, my husband whispered one night near the end before we finally gave up. And maybe that's enough to have had some love sometime, even if it worked only a while. Do you feel that way?
I do. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm going to commit yet. I'm going to go back on the hedge with not being sure I don't want love still. But I do think at a certain point it is very nice to think, well, I had some things that were wonderful. You know, like I lived in a beautiful place like Miami, so no, I don't miss it. I'm glad I lived there. And there has been love, and, you know, that's not the worst achievement to have had it. So I do think one ought to be able to, or I hope I can, take pleasure in some things, even if they're in the past.
Mm. Let me ask you a couple of writing questions, since you're
okay.
The creative professor. I want to know what's your biggest challenge as a writer. It's different for everyone. I talk with many, many writers, and it's always different for each person.
So as a writer who's actually trying to write something?
Yeah.
Well, right now, because I'm a professor and directing a program, it's, well, time. When is there time? And there's time in the summer. So time is probably the cheapest answer you could have asked for. But otherwise, for me, it is finding myself really doing something that is new, feels new and vital, and not, because there's nothing worse than writing something when you're only half on the page. And that's where I had gotten a few years ago when I started writing this, when I couldn't face writing fiction in the more conventional way anymore. And it took a while to come up with a different way to write that felt real and true and energetic again. So I don't know what will be next exactly, but I know that that will be the challenge. How can I find the form again that feels really true and necessary?
Mm. When you're writing fiction, is there a certain kind of scene that's more difficult for you to approach?
A theme? Well, you know what's funny is not so much a theme, but up until now, I had really had a hard time writing from the point of view, whether in the third or the first person, of a woman like myself. I just, for some reason, I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't. And I had an easier time writing about older men or younger men or teenage girls.
Well, that's interesting.
And I don't know that I was doing it that well, but when the closer it got to someone like me, the more I found it really terrible. And it was, I think, writing a memoir that made me first have to speak in my own voice in that way, and then forcing myself in this book also to use the first person from the point of view of a woman who, you know, is about as close to me as you can get while still being made out of paper. So that's not a theme, but it's a position that is the most difficult, and maybe I will have overcome it for the next time. I don't know.
So creativity is such a subjective form. Whether you're creating music or art or film, it doesn't matter. It's very subjective, and I've heard this from many, many people. When do I know it's finished? So how do you know when one of your books is finished?
I think I know when I'm bored, when I feel as though, maybe bored is too strong a word, when I just feel done, I feel empty, I don't have anything more. I mean, usually I will have written it a few drafts and put it away and then read it and done another draft and then I'll go back through all my notes, because I'll have files and files of notes, and go through them all and see what I want to add. And when they start to look to me absolutely irrelevant, I realize, well, I guess I put everything I had in this, and maybe it's done. But then a year goes by, and it's published, and you find yourself giving readings, and you're making revisions all the time. So it was only done for a while, but done enough.
Well, let's talk about rejection because criticism, because, you know,
sure.
That's just part of the game. You know, even when I'm doing commercial writing, you still get rejection and criticism. I mean, it's just part of the game. You deal with it. So I'm wondering how you deal with it. Do you read your reviews? Do you take stock of them? Do you disregard them?
Oh, I read them. I know there are people who don't or say they don't. I do, because partly I feel as though I've put a lot of words out in the world, and I want them back. You know, I want some other words back. And when, you know, so far the reviews for this have been nice. There haven't been that many in main places yet, but the ones I've seen have been really encouraging, and that's good. And so, you know, ask me in a week when I get some nasty one. But no, the painful ones are painful. And what I try and do, because as a teacher of creative writing too, that's something similar that comes up in workshop when students' work is being read and discussed frankly by the peers, is if something strikes your bone and hurts, it's often because it's true, in which case that's good news, because now you can deal with it. And if it just seems irrelevant, then you just say, wait, well, that is not appropriate at all. So, I mean, if it's painful criticism, then that's good for you. Mm. But what's frustrating is when it's something that just seems plain wrong, and there it is in print, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that's just, you just have to turn away and not think about it too much.
Right, right. So you've written, how many books? Five, six?
This is the sixth one.
Yeah. And so, as we said earlier, you're also professor and director of creative writing at the University of Virginia. So let's talk about process and where and how you find the time to write.
Well, that would be the summer. That would be pretty much only the summer. Rewriting is possible during the year, and that can actually be pretty pleasurable. So I think I was revising this last fall. Yes, but I knew that I had to have a full draft really as ready as it could be in by August 15th when everything began. And then revision and extra things can happen after that. But otherwise, during the year, it's out of the question. I don't think any of my colleagues, the poets might be able to manage a little bit, but I think the fiction and other prose writers have a much harder time. Some of them do it, but it's not just time, writers get spooky. They're alone and they want to be kind of fully imagining and inhabiting whatever they're writing. And that's one reason it's good to live alone, because you can thrash around your house and talk out loud and really be in the right zone and not have to be nice to anybody else. And you need several weeks at a time for that to work, I find. I find it very hard to teach and then have one day off and think I'm going to be able to do some writing.
Yes.
So
yes.
I'm sounding like this is very mystical, but it seems to be how it, you have to put your brain in a different place.
Yes, and no, we totally get that. Totally get it. Well, we just talked about criticism and reviews, and you got some really glowing reviews. A crackling incantation, brittle and brilliant and hot and sad and full of sideways humor that devastates and illuminates all at once, Lauren Groff says. She's the author of Fates and Furies. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Jane?
Oh, putting me right on the spot. I think my final thought would be a kind of big love to anyone who is reading books at all right now, and especially willing to read books that are not such conventional animals as this one of mine is not, and generally being very grateful to be read and to be talked to by people like you who think a lot about these things.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time. And listen, if you ever get off that fence and just make a decision one way or the other, I want to hear back from you, okay?
Okay, I will. I'll send word. All right, thank you, Vicky, very much.
Thank you. And my guest, Jane Allison. You can find out more about Jane at janeallisonauthor.com. She's got some interviews up there, and her books are all up there. And this book we talked about today was called Nine Island. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with investigative journalist Frank Lally.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Missing Link supplements, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 9th, it's a best Sunday with Dr. Nels Rasmussen in the studio. Dr. Nels can help with emotional, behavioral, or physical problems. He can test for allergies, drug, or supplement compatibility and dosages for you or your animal friends. Call us for a free remote session. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and, well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck, and I'd be happy to drop it off.
We'd do anything for kids, yet 1 in 5 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger near you. Learn how at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. become a PAWS foster care volunteer. For more information, visit PAWS.org or 425-787-2500. PAWS.org or 425-787-2500.
Coming up October 27th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. What's next? If you've ever asked yourself what's next, learn to double down on your existing strengths, interests, and experiences with Jenny Blake, former Google career strategist and author of Pivot, The Only Move That Matters Is Your Next One. Tune in Mondays at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD3.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Talk radio for the heart and soul. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back. Welcome back, everyone. You know, if you've ever had to deal with healthcare problems, and pretty much everybody has, and they've had to work their way through the maze of health insurance paperwork, you've had to deal with hospital bills, doctor bills that are outrageous, prescription bills, which are even more outrageous these days, then this is an awesome book. My guest, let me tell you a little bit about my guest. And we sat down last week and talked so I could bring this conversation to you. As you can imagine, Frank Lally, it's very difficult sometimes because we do just 1 hour a week to get guests during this specific hour. So we sat down last week and Frank Lally and I talked. He's a prize-winning investigative journalist. He's the former editor of Money, George, and Reader's Digest International magazines, and he worked as an investigative reporter for Forbes. He's currently the special health correspondent for Parade and has devoted his career to getting to the bottom of a good story. So when he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a potentially terminal blood cancer, he turned to his reporter's skills. And ultimately, he got the life-saving drugs that he needed. He was quoted prices between $17,000 a year and a few hundred a year. Huge difference. But he's taken all of this knowledge. He's done over 300 interviews with experts. He spent 3 years of subsequent research and firsthand interviews trying to get to the bottom of some of this healthcare nonsense that we all have to deal with. So let me bring you the conversation right now, and then I'll talk a little bit more about it if we have time at the end. The book is called Your Best Healthcare Now. Get better discounts, save with better health insurance, find affordable prescriptions. Frank Lally. Frank, I'm pleased to have you on the show today. You've built a successful career as a business and investigative journalist. You're now known as the healthcare detective. So let's begin with your personal story. Let's look at how this beat began for you as the healthcare detective. You were diagnosed with a type of blood cancer 8 years ago, treatable but not curable. What were those first few moments like for you when you got that diagnosis?
I was stunned, shocked. I was paralyzed. You know, I said to my doctor, this is deadly serious. And he said, this is serious, but not necessarily deadly. We can control this cancer. And they did. So I was taking a pill. I took it for actually for 5 years. And it worked beautifully for me. I had virtually no side effects. However, that pill cost $570 a day. And what happened was my employer, I ran a magazine called Money. I worked 20 years at Time Inc. My employer covered that cost for a while, but then 1 year decided that it was going to eliminate all caps on drug costs, even for people like me with cancer and these very expensive drugs. But here's where and that's a business decision, I understand that. But here's where the fiasco of the healthcare system comes in. My company could not tell me what that drug was going to cost in the coming year, and nobody else could either. I spent literally weeks. I made 70 phone calls to 16 different organizations. Nobody could tell me what that drug was going to cost. Some people said, it's going to be negligible, $2 a day. Other people said $17,000 a year. My wife said, you have to write about this. This is ridiculous. So I wrote a piece in the New York Times. It went viral. And then I got letters from readers And they had, in some cases, worse stories than mine. I ended up figuring out how to get a grant to cover the entire cost of the drug. It didn't cost me a penny, okay? But other people were paying out of pocket or not having their drugs at all or going to the doctor because they didn't think they could afford it. So out of that, I said, look, health care is now going to become my beat, and I'm going to write a book to help people, ordinary people, do everything that I have been able to do in my years with this multiple myeloma, get quality, affordable health care, and in many cases save money too. Get doctor discounts, get better health insurance, get affordable prescriptions. I've done all of that, and it's not difficult to do. Anybody with a telephone and a pad and a pencil can do what I did.
Right. It is really staggering. What struck me were the range in prices, and you just mentioned them. They broke down to like $571 per day to just around $2 a day. When you're sick, I mean, the last thing you need to do is be calling around making all these phone calls. You said it was the, even after all of your years of investigative reporting, it was the most confounding reporting challenge you've had.
That's absolutely true, and that's because I couldn't get a straight answer. But I think a lot of people dealing with the healthcare system can't get straight answers. I'll give you a perfect example. You get referred to a specialist, okay, and then the specialist that you actually need, you actually can't see him. You can't see him for months. This happens a lot to Medicare patients, and here's why: a Medicare patient is going to pay $40 for the visit, where a regular paying customer with insurance is going to pay $400. So guess what? They're not going to return your phone call so fast. You're not at the top of their list. So what do? In that case, go back to the doctor who referred you. You know why? Because they're pals. And not that he didn't refer you to a good doctor, but they're reciprocal arrangements, okay? So you go back to the original doctor and say, hey, I'm having trouble getting to that specialist. Bingity bing, a couple of phone calls, and all of a sudden you're at the top of the list. There's a lack of transparency in the healthcare system that's really confounding. Why do we have a system where doctors don't list their prices? Very few hospitals do. Insurance companies, people get fired if they give you a written quote. Why do we put up with it? I mean, I understand it's capitalism, but this is out of control unless you know how to fight it.
And it also seems so very subjective, because I've heard of people going to the same place and receiving different quotes. Did you find that in your research?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure, absolutely. What you need to understand about doctors and providers, they have maybe 30, you know, let's say 30, okay? They have about 30 contracts with 30 different insurance companies. Now, they have a set price they've got a list of prices, right, for everything they do. But then they negotiate with the insurance company based on how many customers the insurance company will bring in. And, the lowest amount of price is to the people who bring in the most. So that's Medicare and Medicaid. So if you're with a doctor, for example, if you're with a doctor and he says to you, you know, you need blood tests, it's going to cost maybe $1,200, but I think it's really important. And you say, geez, that's not in my budget. You've got to look the doctor in the eye. He's not going to bring it up. You have to tell him you need a discount. That's more money than you can afford. But one of the things you can say to the doctor is, I understand you take Medicare patients. Can you charge me what you're charging the Medicare patients? I mean, that's an open door. But also, when you have that conversation, again, you're bringing it up, right? I can't afford that. Many doctors have standing policies about discounts. They just have to believe that, sincerely, you can't afford it, they'll cut their prices in half or down to 10%. Look, doctors go into the profession to help people, and many of them don't want dollars to get in between them and their patients. I have a doctor who, at the end of every examination, no matter how complicated, says to me, look, I'm thinking of charging you this much for it. Can you afford that? Now, very few doctors do that. And I said, you know, that's amazing that you do that. He said, look, I've been in practice for a long time. I don't have to put my kids through school any longer. I've got patients I've taken care of all their lives. In some cases, they can't afford to pay me anymore. What can I do? Kick him out on the street?
Right. Well, I read in one article where you negotiated with one doctor. You had a couple of back surgeries, and you were originally quoted around $40,000. Then the business side of the practice comes back to you with a different offer. I think it was $20,000, and then they come back with $15,000, and then eventually $10,000.
I said I call them back. If $15,000 sounded like their final offer. But, you know, I talked to my wife, and then I called. I had no insurance. This was completely out of my pocket. And I called back and said, all we can afford is 10. And the doctor said, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
look, if he did the operation for Medicare, he would have gotten $1,500.
Oh, good.
So he actually, you know, doing it for me, he got $10,000 cash. You know, he got $10,000 cash. He had no hassles with any insurance companies. That's business. That's the business side. I'll tell you the human side. He's a terrific guy. He's a tremendously compassionate doctor. He's also one of the best surgeons in the world, honestly. So he's a guy who wants to help people.
Yeah.
When I woke up in the hospital, that was the first face I saw, and it was the middle of July in the summer in New York, and I said, shouldn't you be in the Hamptons? Joke, joke. And he said, no, I should be here with my patients. I should be here with you. That's most doctors in America have that point of view. You just have to tap it.
Okay, and so there you list a whole book, throughout this book, I mean, there are many, many, many suggestions where we can save money. So one of the things I want to look at is how we save money on our prescription costs. I'm thinking like the EpiPen just went up. I mean, over the last couple of years, it's gone up from like $100 for two EpiPens to $600. But that's just one incident. There are many, many of these out there. So what are some of the ways we can save money on our prescription costs?
Well, there are many ways. You know, in the EpiPen situation, there's you have to think about whether there's an alternative to it. I mean, where they were able to double and triple prices is where they have monopolies, and that makes things difficult. But it really starts in the doctor's office. When the doctor says, you know, I think you need a prescription for X, you have to say to him, okay, why that medicine, why that dose? And if he can convince you that you need that, you have to say, okay, tell me what it is going to do to me in what time frame. And he'll say, okay, look, with the condition you have, you should feel better, you know, actually in 7 days it should take care of your condition. Okay, at that point you say, okay, write me the prescription for 10 days, not 30 days. Okay, and then I'll get back. If it hasn't worked, we can get another drug. But I'm not buying $30 pills when I only need 10. You should see my medicine cabinet before I figured this out.
Wow.
I have medicines where I only needed 4. They sold me 90.
That's shocking. Isn't that shocking?
While you're having this conversation with them, so you're getting the right dose and you're getting the right amount, then you say to them, by the way, do you have any samples? I mean, these drug makers drop off samples of their drugs. In some cases, you know, they're drawers full of them. Cabinet. I walked out of one doctor's office with more than $1,000 worth of a non-addictive painkiller. And all I said was, do you have any samples? And he said, oh, do I have samples? He opens the drawer. His nurse starts, I could hardly carry this stuff home. But it was a pill at $25 a pill. And he gave me more than $1,000 worth with a simple question like that. Another one is, do you have any drug discount cards? Almost all of the brand name drugs, especially the stuff you see on TV, they have, especially when they're introducing a drug, they have these discount cards. So you can buy a $250 drug for $10, maybe for an entire year. Now, why are the makers doing that? Well, they're doing that to get you hooked on the medicine so that you become a long-term patient, okay? But if you approach it as, let me try this, okay, and make sure it really helps me, and then I can figure out other ways to get it at a lower cost. I've invested like, you know, maybe 4 months on a drug, and I decide whether or not I want to do it. So that's a $40 trial instead of a $1,000 trial.
Right, right. And so, as you said, the hospitals never list price ranges. So if we've got a huge hospital bill, you say don't work through the billing department.
No, don't do that. What you should do in hospitals, and this is your point about sort of planning ahead. Look, you don't negotiate when you're on the gurney in the operating room, okay? I mean, in the operating room or in the ER. I mean, that's not the time to say,
right,
hold on a
right.
minute, now let's talk about cost here. You have to plan ahead, but think about it. Even in my condition with a blood cancer, I've planned out my care. I've got plenty of time to make decisions about what hospital I'm going to, what care, what pill I'm going to take. I'm not rushing. I'm rarely rushing to the hospital to treat a condition. So I've got plenty of time to think ahead. So if you're having a baby, if you're having an operation, if you've got other times you know you're going to a hospital, do a little shopping. I mean, first of all, if there's a good, big teaching hospital near you, that's probably your best option. Go to that hospital. Don't go to the billing department. They're there to collect money. Ask for the ombudsman or somebody close to that. They've got it. Every hospital has people like that who want to sit down with the patients and make the visit at the hospital effective and productive. Sit down with them, explain your situation, the care you need, and essentially you're gonna get a bid. You're gonna negotiate. You know, that price is too high. They cut their prices. They can also give you a plan where you pay over time. And then you can take that plan, by the way, if you're not happy with it, and go around the corner to the other hospital. Believe me, these hospitals are competing with each other. Turn on your TV, you see hospitals advertising all the time now to get patients in. So approach it the way you would, you know, the way you'd approach it if you were going out to buy a rug or a couch.
Right.
You know, you'd visit a couple of stores, you'd look around, it's the same thing. It's the same thing with healthcare, and if you think about it, you have plenty of time to do it, and you're going to save money. You're going to get quality care because you're making a judgment about that hospital,
right?
Doing some research on that hospital, but you're also going to get an affordable price.
Okay, and I want to just get this one last question in here, Frank, if we can. You say employers, the consumer-directed health plans are not as good as they sound. So what is a consumer-directed health plan? Why isn't it as good as it sounds?
Consumer-directed health plan is just another word for a high-deductible plan. So if you're healthy, okay, so the premiums are low, but the deductible is very high. So I love the premium, okay, but the deductible is very high. So if you're healthy and you never go to the doctor or go very rarely, that's a great health, that's great insurance, right? But if you get sick, by the way, if you have a car accident, and I'll tell you, this is honest to God in our family, one of members of my family badly wrenched his ankle because he was chased by a rabid cat and ended up in the ER.
Oh my gosh.
My point is, anything can happen.
Right.
So you want to look at the deductible and the out-of-pocket maximum and ask yourself this question: if the worst happens to me, can I actually afford that? Now, you know, 625,000 families go bankrupt in this country. Most of them, the leading cause is medical bills, and most of them had insurance. Just at the end of the day, couldn't afford to pay the bill even with the insurance.
Well, I'm going to spend a lot more time looking at my plan from now on. I seriously am. I mean, there was some terrific information you shared with us just now, and the book is packed full of a lot more information. The book is called Your Best Healthcare Now. Get doctor discounts, save with better health insurance, find affordable prescriptions. What's a final thought you want to leave our listeners with, Frank?
What I want to leave, you have the power because to negotiate your price, because everything in healthcare is negotiable. And with this book and the hints and tips and telephone numbers available here, and by the way, a plain English glossary at the end, so they can't just talk healthcare to you, healthcare ease or insurance ease to you any longer. That glossary spells out every term they use in plain English. So I'm empowering you to take control of your health and get affordable, quality care and save some money too.
Well, thank you so much, Frank Lally. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Frank Lally, Tom Brokaw, special correspondent for NBC News, says that world-class journalist Frank Lally used his cancer diagnosis to explore how to navigate the healthcare system. His advice has been invaluable to me, and I'm confident it will be so to many others.
Frank also shares in the book many recommendations about your annual checkup, antibiotics, over-the-counter medicine, how to calculate your total medical costs before you pick up an insurance plan. It is just jam-packed full of this really great information and very thoroughly researched. Well, we have to run. I had a great story I wanted to share with you, but we've run out of time today. So that's going to have to wait until next week. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and I thank you for spending this hour with us. You can find me at conversationslive.net at 800-495-7617. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.